heard so much about you."
Abruptly shy, she retreated and bowed her head.
"She's never met a mother of your caliber."
All but crushed by the hug, Holly held on to her stern expression, but her eyes had softened. She took a step to the kitchen and shouted to one of her boys.
"Nine guests," she called. "They'll be wanting supper."
"We have our own food," Winter began. Jester put up an arm to stop Winter from speaking.
"We'd be happy to enjoy your legendary cooking."
Catching the warning, Winter smiled.
"As he says."
The group entered the kitchen, but Holly caught Raiden's arm, holding him back.
"Soldier," she said, lowering her tone. "I suppose you've come to take possession of our army."
"Nonsense," Raiden said, and then smiled. "They called me soldier, not general." Surprised and gratified by his response, Holly inclined her head, and the two entered the spacious kitchen, which felt cramped with so many. As with every meal in the house, the food was exemplary, and Winter claimed that the whole of the guild could not surpass it. The two boys that had helped Holly cook flushed all the way to their ears and stammered their gratitude. After the meal, Raiden and his companions were led to their own quarters at the top of the house, where Holly ordered her boys out to provide the soldier and his lieutenant's room. Winter and the Verinai were given the basement. Holly then led Raiden on a tour of the army.
"This is truly impressive," Raiden said as they walked along the rows of tents.
She shrugged dismissively.
3,000 children is not so different from 7.
"Most mothers would disagree with you," Raiden said.
She laughed. "Perhaps."
"They do not like the presence of our Verinai friends," Raiden said.
"They are still learning discipline," she replied.
"They get to sleep in the house, while we sleep on the ground."
Raiden glanced towards the speaker, and the sullen group drifted away. Winter still stood on the porch, talking to John and Red, but many cast veiled glares at her and her Verinai companions. A shout drew Raiden from his thoughts, and he looked to the fort. Marrow was playing on the tree ship with John and Holly's youngest, the cries of delight making it difficult to discern which was the child.
"Resentment runs deep," Holly said. "When the Empire took over, they kidnapped any leaders that failed to support them. Most were executed. Others returned after swearing allegiance to the Empress Council."
"Did no one fight?"
"Many," Holly said. "But the oracles foresaw the gatherings. Empire battle mages arrived and slaughtered them. The message became very clear. Fight and die. Submit and live."
"And you didn't?"
"Some of the defiant sought to fight, and we lost a handful. Then we received your message and changed our tactics to scouting. When the Empire pulled back their army and began construction on Herosian, we gathered our forces and hundreds joined our ranks. They may be undisciplined, but they hate the Verinai and the Empire."
"Still," Raiden said, eyeing yet another group glaring at Marrow.
"Perhaps it's best we move on before your forces begin to revolt."
Holly barked an order, and the group separated.
"They'll be fine," she said. "In such a conflict, we do not get to choose our allies."
"True," Raiden said. "But we are fortunate to have such strong friends. Winter and her friends sacrificed everything to save us at Herosian, and they are now traitors to the Empire. If caught, they will be executed."
"We have scouts 2 days out," she said, "and John came up with a series of flags to relay a warning. If they're coming, we'll know."
Raiden smiled, recalling John's inventive nature. As much as Holly was the general, her husband was the innovator, and his farm was dotted with examples of his handiwork. His creations made farming, washing the linens, and even bathing easier for his family. And prior to the Mage War, he'd actually begun selling his work.
"Does he have any ideas for the war?" Raiden asked.
She smiled and pointed to the barn, where a series of swords were fastened to a rotating wheel, the weapons sharpening against the whetstone. The machine was flawless, shifting the swords to sharpen along the entire length of the blades. "He never stops tinkering," she said. "Even when he should." Her eyes drifted to the tree ship, where her daughter and Marrow stood at the helm, pretending to be captains of a pirate vessel. It had been over a year since Raiden had stood on the deck and spoken to Alidian's light-cast bird. In the interval, John had added to the back of the ship, nearly doubling the size of the whimsical vessel. "How does he find the time?" Raiden asked.
"His machines do a great deal of the farm work," she said, a soft smile appearing on her face. "He says he creates so he can play."
"He's a good man," Raiden said, "and lucky to have a general as his wife." His smile faded as he thought of Alidian, and he looked away. Misinterpreting his expression, Holly laughed lightly.
"He doesn't mind my appointment," she said. "He's never been one to lead."
"I know," he said, turning back to her. "And we'll need leadership in the coming weeks. How soon can you march?"
"A couple of days," she said. "Where is our destination?"
"Herosian," he said. "With what she will face, Alidian will require as much force as she can muster."
"I still don't understand why," she said. "Why would the oracles gather their forces to a single location?"
"A question without an answer," he replied. "By all accounts, it's tactically foolish, but then the oracles see much more than I."
"And Alidian?" Holly asked. "Can she stop Taraya and Marissa?"
"Did you see Dawn's Keep?"
She shook her head. "The tales are disturbing enough. If rumors are accurate, she destroyed a citadel and a city in her escape. It's nothing but ruins now."
"She was in solitude for a year," he replied, and mentally added, "She came back different."
"But can Alidian stop them?"
"I believe she can," Raiden said. "But Taraya has a plan for victory, and I suspect we are approaching the final stages of this war."
"Then we'd better be ready," she said.
She called out to one of her daughters, who was busy refilling water skins from a barrel on a cart. John had placed a latch at the base that allowed the girl to fill the water skins as the soldiers lined up. The girl passed her duties to her younger sister and dutifully approached.
"Mother?" she asked.
Holly gestured to Raiden.
"The soldier and his companions have been on the road for some time. Gather their clothes and have them washed and dried by nightfall."
"Yes, mother," she said.
"You don't have to do that," Raiden protested, as the girl departed.
"Yes, we do," Holly said, wrinkling her nose. "You might be fine with ill-smelling soldiers, but not in my army."
Raiden burst into a laugh and readily agreed. The day of respite was marred by the undercurrent of tension from the bulk of the army. Revealed in glares and muttered profanity, they voiced their sentiments regarding the Verenai. Holly sought to quell the unrest, but the sentiment lingered into the night. When Raiden finally retreated to his room, he found it difficult to cast it aside. Would the people ever trust the Verenai? Or was the guild doomed, regardless of their respective actions in the war? He watched Marrow cast a toy bear out of air and give it to one of Holly's children. Raiden reclined on his bed but kept his armor close at hand. Throughout the day, he'd seen too much anger on the faces of the men and women in the camp and could not entirely shake his unease. Unwilling to reveal his fears to the others, he pretended to remove his armor and weapons in the dark and then reclined on the floor. But Raiden couldn't sleep. The image of hatred directed at Winter stuck in his thoughts. Although he tried to shake his doubt, the fear would not dissipate. His mind said he slept among friends, but his heart told him they were foes. He tried to fight the thought, to convince himself that all was well, but as the minutes passed, his skin began to crawl. In the darkness, he listened for the silent approach of an assassin, and his hand crept towards the hilt of his sword. Abruptly, Jester blew out his breath and sat up. "Am I the only one feeling this?"
Red groaned.
"Blast you, I was almost asleep."
"Are you not worried?" Jester asked.
"You know I am," she said, also sitting up. "But why do I feel fear?"
"She doesn't like it either," Marrow said, yawning as she rolled over.
Raiden shook his head and came to his feet. "Whatever the cause, we must depart."
"Now?"
Red asked. "Now," Raiden said. "Gather your gear, but do so quietly. I'll warn Winter." Jester nodded and stood, but in the dim light it was clear he was already dressed for combat.
"I'm ready," he said sheepishly.
Red sighed and stood.
"I as well."
"How did you know what was coming?"
Marrow grumbled, reaching for her travel clothes. Raiden flashed a tight smile.
"I'll be back. Be ready."
He slipped out the door and descended the steps. After numerous visits to the home, he knew which steps creaked and passed them by. It was after midnight, but the dark house felt foreign, and he kept his hand on his sword hilt. He crept to the base of the stairs and noticed a light in the front room. Gliding to the doorway, he spotted Holly poring over a map.
"Holly," he whispered, and she looked up.
"Raiden," she asked, "what are you doing?" Then she noticed his stance and frowned.
"Do we face a threat?"
Winter drifted out of the darkness of the basement stairwell.
"I, too, would like to know the answer to that question."
"You feel it as well?"
Raiden asked.
"We do," she said. "My command is preparing for flight."
Holly straightened and stepped to the door.
"I'll wake the watch."
"No,"
Raiden said quickly, stepping past her to the door. He peered out the window and scanned the darkness.
"I don't understand," Holly said.
"What's going on?"
Winter joined him at the curtains, but an instant later she sucked in her breath.
"What do you see?"
Raiden murmured.
"We're surrounded," she said.
"By whom?" Holly asked, squinting into the darkness.
"How did they get past the army?"
Then Raiden saw it as well, the shadows of soldiers forming ranks around the house, drawing weapons and lighting torches. The bursts of light illuminated faces filled with dark intent, of hatred and fear. They also revealed their identities.
"Our foes didn't get past the army,"
Raiden said, his stomach tightening.
"They are the army."
Chapter 23. Captain Marrow.
"I don't understand," Holly repeated, staring through the window. "They're your army. Why are they attacking?"
"Because of us," Winter said, her tone filled with regret.
"Once we depart, I'm sure they will forsake their mutiny."
"Can you hear what they're saying?"
Raiden asked, pointing to the trio at the heart of the mob. She cast a tiny mouse from the dim light and sent it down the stairs. A moment later, the Verinai ascended. Their caution marked their understanding of the situation, and one of the Verinai stepped to the window.
"Loth is a body mage," Winter said. "He can enhance his hearing so we can know their conversation."
Loth cocked his head to the side and closed his eyes. He frowned as he listened to the conversation taking place a short distance from the house. Then his expression registered surprise and then anger.
"It's not just us they wish to kill," he said. "It appears they wish to eliminate the soldier as well."
"Why?"
Holly demanded.
"They aren't saying," he said. "They must think he betrayed them."
"I'm sorry," Winter said. "I had no desire to cause a division among you."
"There's more,"
the man said. His eyes widened and flicked to Holly.
"They want you as well."
Holly's expression would have melted iron, and she strode to the door. Raiden caught her before she reached the handle and spun her about, lowering his tone as he spoke in a rush.
"Why would they turn against you?"
"I'll have them in the stocks for this,"
she snarled.
"The whole army?" Raiden asked.
Lorth nodded apologetically.
"It looks like they are surrounding the house."
"What about the Defiant?" Raiden asked.
He shook his head.
"It doesn't look like they have joined them."
He grunted and then pointed south.
"They've been bound and gagged outside the camp. They are talking about them like they are captives."
"They mean to attack my house?"
Holly struggled in Raiden's grip.
"I fed them!"
"There's more to this than just the Varanai," Raiden said,
and quickly described what had happened in the village of Laurendale.
"You think the Empire is behind a mutiny?"
Holly demanded, finally going still.
"Is that possible?"
Winter bore a strange expression on her face.
"There is a rumor among the guild of a master that sought to manipulate loyalty."
"Master Skirl?"
the other Varanai scoffed.
"A rumor, no more."
"That's not a rumor,"
Raiden said, stabbing a finger toward the rebellious army.
"Whatever we're going to do, we need to act fast," Lorth said. "They're getting ready to charge."
Jester, Red, and a yawning Marrow descended the stairs, and Jester said,
"We saw them. What's the plan?"
John stepped into view and tucked in his shirt. Evidently roused by Jester, he blinked the sleep away and shook his head.
"We can't kill them," he protested. "They're friends and neighbors."
"They've betrayed us," Holly snapped.
"They deserve the fate of traitors."
"Mommy,"
a girl said, coming down the stairs and rubbing her eyes.
"What's going on?"
"Gather your siblings," she growled, "and prepare your weapons."
"Holly,"
John said, straightening,
"I'm not letting you take our children into battle."
"Don't argue with me, John," she hissed.
"We're running out of time," Lorth warned. "They're starting to advance."
Raiden stepped between the husband and wife.
"We aren't going to kill them. We're going to leave."
"I'm not going to abandon my home," Holly growled. "I'm going to stay."
John stepped to her, his voice swelling with emotion.
"Holly, our house is not our home. It is our children. We will do as the soldier directs, and we will save our family."
For an instant it seemed she would argue, and then she gave a curt nod and turned to the soldier.
"What would you have us do?"
Her voice betrayed a trace of fear, and for the first time Raiden saw the burden she'd carried for her family. She'd hidden it from her husband, her newly acquired army, even her children. But to one accustomed to shouldering the lives of others, Raiden saw through the facade.
"We will lead them away," Raiden said, gesturing to his companions. "When we do, free the Defiant and get them to Herosion. From there you can join Alidian's forces."
"And you?"
John asked.
"We escape," he replied.
"How?" Winter asked. "They have the house surrounded."
"The tree ship," he said, looking out the window again.
"We can jump to it and get past their line."
Winter was nodding.
"Clever. Perhaps we will not have to spill their blood."
"They will pursue us," Red said.
"I'm counting on it," Raiden replied.
"Holly, get my Defiant out."
"Aye," she said. "John, gather the children."
He caught her hand and nodded, and a wealth of love passed between them. Then he turned and ascended the steps, collecting his daughter into his arms. Raiden inclined his head to Holly, and then leapt up the stairs after John, reaching the northern bedroom with his companions and the Varanai trailing.
"Remember," he said, pausing at the window,
"we want them to see us. Holly will need time to escape."
"And no killing?"
Marrow asked. She'd been surprisingly quiet, but her eyes were bright with excitement, as if she'd woken in the middle of the night to discover a dragon at her door. She was veritably dancing from foot to foot, drawing looks from the Varanai.
"Not this time," Red said. Her eyes glowed with mischief.
"Then our ship awaits."
Darting around Raiden, she leapt through the window and landed on the roof of the back porch. He tried to stop her, but heard a great groaning of wood, followed by shouts of surprise and the thudding of footsteps. He instinctively rotated to look and spotted the tree ship, sailing towards them. The great oak glided forward, its huge roots and branches plunging into the earth as it charged, its branches cradling the ship like it floated upon the ocean. Men cried out and dived away as the roots flailed into them, knocking them aside as the ship banked to dock against the house, awaiting its captain. Releasing a cry of exultation, Marrow leapt onto the dock and caught the helm, casting over her shoulder, "You have permission to come aboard!" "How does she do that?" Winter breathed, her voice tinged with awe. Raiden grunted in amusement.
"I think it's best not to question."
Jester smirked.
"And enjoy the ride."
He leapt through the window and dropped onto the ship.
"Captain," he said, offering a mock salute.
"Man the rigging,"
she giggled, and the upper branches coiled into great sails, the leaves bending and overlapping to form sails. Marrow's childlike humor was infectious, and despite Raiden's conflicted emotions, he grinned and joined Jester. One by one the others followed until all had boarded the vessel. When the last of the Verenai alighted on the deck, Marrow spun the wheel, and the ship banked to the north. The mob had recovered, and they surged into ranks to stop their escape. Drawn to the sounds of conflict, those on the opposite side of the house charged around the structure. Their shouts of alarm pierced the night.
"Traitor! Your death is at hand! Your magic cannot save you!"
Marrow looked back to the Verenai.
"A gust of wind, if you please."
The Verenai grinned, and those with air magic reached to the wind, channeling it into the leafy sails. They swelled to contain it, and the ship glided forward, accelerating towards the line. Marrow turned the helm, the ship responding as if on the sea. Her maniacal laughter boomed across the forces, causing many to stumble back. Roots coiled and slammed into the ground, carrying the ship forward on waves of wood. Others flicked outward, striking the line and knocking men sprawling, their helmets soaring through the air.
"Repel boarders!" Marrow shouted.
Raiden took a position on one side and used his sword to strike at the torches being thrown onto the ship, knocking them away. Red and Winter joined him, and the Verenai cast more wind charms, sending gusts into the hasty missiles. Arrows and crossbow bolts were knocked wide. Others plunged into the wood of the tree. Red gestured to the delighted Marrow, who'd conjured a gigantic hat of light to complete her appearance of captain.
"I had an imagination as a child," Red said. "But she gets to make her imagination come to life."
"We're riding a ship, inside a tree, away from marauders," Winter remarked. "She's making my dreams come true." Their former allies desperately sought to stop the ship with fire, but the effort seemed futile. Then a collection of dwarves gathered ahead and cast a wall of fire, the flames burning white hot.
"Hard to port!" Red shouted,
and Marrow banked to starboard, causing Raiden to stumble to the deck.
"I said port!"
Red said, also on her knees.
"Is that right or left?"
Marrow called back.
"Left!"
they chorused. But it was too late. The wall of fire had boxed them into the corner between the army, the fire, and the barn. Raiden deflected another thrown torch and then leapt to Marrow. He pointed to the roof.
"It's just a big wave," he said.
She giggled and leaned back, the ship responding in kind, the roots pushing the prow upward. Limbs reached for the barn and pierced the wall, wrapping around the timbers and supports, lifting the ship off the ground. Like a huge spider, the trees scuttled up the barn to the roof. Raiden clung to the rail as it went vertical, unable to stop his laughter as they scaled the barn like a ship breaching a mammoth wave. More laughter wafted across the ship, contrasting with the cries of dismay from the mob. The structure groaned as the tree sailed up and across. Then the ship's hull slammed into the roof and careened down the opposite side. Free of the trap, the ship sailed across the farm and up the slope, outstripping any pursuit on its way into the night. "Stop them!" their pursuers screamed. Marrow's high-pitched laughter was their answer. They crested a rise, and Raiden watched the destroyed farm fade into the distance. The tree's passage had rent the earth, leaving craters and a trail of devastation over the barn. Holes pockmarked the roof and walls where the limbs had found purchase, and fire burned inside, spreading to the entire structure. Over the rising flames, Raiden spotted Holly and John freeing the Defiant. On the opposite side of the farm, Holly looked back. Although he couldn't see the woman's expression, her posture was one of anger and loss. Then she turned and left her home behind. Sadness gradually replaced his amusement, and one by one the others sobered. Eventually, Marrow too sensed the seriousness of the moment and looked at Raiden, her eyebrow going up.
"She wants to know where to sail."
Raiden turned to Winter.
"Where would we find Master Skirl?"
She raised her hands in a helpless gesture, but the body mage stepped forward.
"He was split tri-mage," he said. "Water and air, as well as his rumored unique talent."
"Prior to the Empire, Elsin used to travel to a village north of Herosian," Winter said, nodding. "I assumed she had a refuge she used as a retreat from the pressures of her office. But what if she was preparing a contingency plan?"
"What's the village?" Red asked.
"Willowbrook," Winter said. "It's a fishing village on the southern bank of Blue Lake." Raiden turned to Marrow.
"Can you get us there?"
"She says yes."
All at once, the tree collapsed, causing the boat to drop to the ground and skid to a halt. Knocked to the deck, Raiden groaned as he pulled his way to his feet and turned to Marrow, who stood with the broken helm in her hands.
"She says no."
Raiden nodded.
"We've got a long way to go, and not much time," he said. "We all know what will happen if this plague spreads to Illidan's army. Let's get moving."
They nodded and disembarked the tree ship. In the midst of an empty field, the lone ship rested partially on its side, its railing broken and burnt, its hull cracked. As they walked away, Raiden couldn't shake the feeling he'd abandoned their broken dreams. Chapter 24 Cornered. Toron stepped free of the swamp and breathed deep of the clean air. Galathon, too, seemed relieved, and they camped a mile from the Evermist. Toron pored over the map. He'd shown the map and the notes to Galathon, but the troll had merely shrugged.
"I'm not the tracker," he said. "I only care about killing Elsin."
With a destination in mind, they worked their way to Keith. Rumors were rampant about a Lydian invading the Empire and of Elenir turning into a spirit. Herosian had become the Empire's capital, and Tyria was prepared to destroy the Griffin army. The news hastened their steps, with even Galathon feeling the press of time. Reaching Keith, Galathon gathered his crew, and they embarked on his ship, their destination an island in the open sea. After everything they'd endured together, Toron felt that he'd gained the rock troll's respect. But that respect did not extend to the crew. They eyed him with thinly veiled contempt throughout the journey, and he spent much of his time in his quarters. As they approached the location on the map, a crewman spotted an island in the distance. Graced with towering crystalline spires and wondrous structures, the island was obviously one created by the ancients. Yet none of the sailors had ever seen it.
"How does an island just appear?"
one grumbled.
It's cursed,
another muttered.
Word is that ships disappear in this region. Now we know the cause.
Galathon ignored them and ordered the helmsman to turn towards the island. Barking orders for them to stand ready, Galathon shoved his way to the rail. Toron watched the coastline until a handful of broken hulls became visible on the shore, some newer than others.
The Isle of the Dead!
A man cried. Galathon glared at him, and the man fell silent. Then Galathon ordered them to circle the island. Toron examined the strange buildings and pristine streets, but his eyes were drawn to the massive towers that rose from the center of the island. Nothing moved, but the aura of dread crept over each of them, instilling a fearful silence, only broken by the creak of the boat and the sea lapping at the hull. They passed around the far side of the island, and Toron squinted, noticing a small opening against the sea cliff. He withdrew the map and notes and scanned to the second page, where he found a sketch of the cliff and entrance. There, Toron said, pointing to the door. Galathon pushed the helmsman aside and spun the wheel, banking them towards the island. With a deft twist, he brought them to a soft halt against the cliff, and all eyes lifted to the door. Instead of at the level of the ocean, the door was 20 feet up, a short dock extending into thin air, as if waiting for a flying ship to dock. The opening itself was a single recessed door.
"Why build a dock above the water?" someone asked. "Hort," Galathon said. "You have the ship. If we do not return by nightfall, sail half a mile to the north, and return each day at noon."
Toron stepped to the rigging and scaled to the crow's nest. Timing the rise and fall of the ship, he leapt to the dock and cautiously approached the door. The dock trembled as Galathon and a dozen members of his crew followed, and a moment later Toron reached the door. He paused to listen, and then dipped into his magic to see if there was any heat behind the door. In the shadows of the alcove, footprints of heat were just visible, as if someone had stood there just moments ago.
"Someone was here," Toron murmured. "They've seen our approach." "Elsin?"
Toron shook his head.
"I can't be sure, but I think it's best I open this door. Wouldn't you agree?"
The rock troll grinned, and Severon snorted. Galathon gestured an invitation, and Toron approached the door. The circular portal was barely large enough for Galathon to enter. There was no latch, but when Toron stepped forward to examine it, the barrier rolled into the stone to the side, revealing an ancient passage stretching away into darkness.
"Who enters the ominous passage first?"
Grogin asked.
"Not I,"
Lynx muttered. Toron stepped over the threshold and began to advance, working his way up the sloped corridor. Severon fell into step behind him, the Mind Reaver padding behind Galathon and the other members of his crew. On silent feet they crept up the corridor until they reached an enormous cavern. Filling nearly the whole of the small mountain, the cavern stretched for 1,000 feet in one direction and a few hundred in the other. Toron sucked in his breath as he saw the strange machinery that dominated the walls of the cave. A pair of tunnels extended away, presumably going to the city. Strange lights and symbols marked the machinery, and paths navigated through pipes and glowing columns. Other tunnels extended away, but all were blocked by barriers. The sole exception was a tunnel bound by thick glass. It turned beneath the machinery before curving east. The corridor was clearly intended to keep its occupants trapped, but who was it intended for? Toron stepped to the tunnel and touched its wall. It was not aqua glass, or even regular glass. Whatever it was, it felt incredibly strong.
"What is this place?"
a sailor breathed.
"Doesn't matter," Galathon growled. "We're here for Elsin. Severon?"
The Mind Reaver padded about, pausing as if sampling the air. Then it stalked forward and halted at the end of the transparent tunnel. It swayed side to side and then released a low snarl.
I'm not going in there, a human exclaimed.
Galathon picked him up by the throat and launched him through the opening. He bounced off a wall and tumbled to a stop, but nothing happened. Toron frowned at the display but shook his head.
This could be a trap, Toron murmured. If this door shuts behind us...
Galathon grunted and then swung his axe. The huge blade smashed into a hinge, shattering it into bits of metal. The door groaned and fell onto its side, the second hinge snapping under the strain.
She can't shut us in now, Galathon said. Get moving.
Toron would have preferred to keep their entry silent, but Galathon was anything but subtle. Scowling, he entered the tunnel with the rock troll and tried to suppress his unease. The path led deep into the machinery. Visible through the transparent walls and ceiling, the giant chamber contained an odd assortment of pipes and spheres, many of which were marked by color and strange symbols. Galathon struck the wall with his axe and frowned when it made no damage. Before he could strike harder, Toron shook his head.
She may know we're here, he said, but let's try to surprise her.
The troll grunted in irritation but held his curiosity in check. A moment later, the corridor turned and left the machines behind. Led by the Mind Reaver, the group crept down the dim tunnel until it reached its end at a set of stairs. Toron peered upward and realized the stairs led to a second chamber. He hesitated, but Galathon strode upward. Cursing the troll under his breath, Toron followed. The room at the top of the stairs was cavernous, and dark enough Toron couldn't see the walls. Then he spotted an opening across from the stairs that led to a hall. They advanced towards it, but Lynx darted ahead of him and stepped through. Then he leapt to a pedestal and slapped his hand onto a rune. Light blossomed in the chamber, causing them to shield their eyes. Rooms ringed the circular space, each facing the central room, while stairs allowed access to the higher levels. One by one the bandits and marauders cursed, and then Toron realized it was because they recognized the chamber. It was a prison.
Out!
Galathon barked.
Too late, Lynx said.
He smirked and touched another rune, causing the opening in the clear wall to slam shut, separating Lynx from the rest of them. Realizing they'd been betrayed, Toron sprinted for the way they'd entered.
Back the way we came, he shouted.
They whirled, but the steps were already rising, each one lifting straight up until they merged together, blending into the floor without seam or joint. Toron's gut tightened as he realized Elsin had used the ancient's prison to trap them. Then Elsin stepped from the shadows to join Lynx. Her features smug, she came to a halt on the other side of a transparent wall and folded her arms. Galathon roared and charged, bringing his axe down upon the barrier with all his might. The weapon bounced off, leaving no mark on the smooth surface. Elsin watched as Galathon continued to strike at the barrier. Although he doubted it would be effective, Toron stepped to the troll's side and added fire to the effort, and the other sailors did the same, striking at the transparent wall with blade and magic. Their desperate attempt to breach the wall waned when it became clear it was futile. Still standing with her arms folded, Elsin watched them until they finally stopped trying. Then her smile widened, and she swept her hand at the prison.
Welcome to the City of Dawn, she said.
Her voice sounded like it came from within the room. Galathon barked an order and the group spread out, searching for a way to reach her. But the woman simply regarded Toron with a frown.
No cage will stop me from killing you,
Galathon snarled, and then pointed his axe at Lynx.
Or the traitor.
She paid me well, Lynx said. How could I refuse?
Elsin laughed, her voice filled with scorn. Then she turned to Toron.
Hello, husband.
Our joining is over, he said with a scowl. I'm not your husband anymore.
She shrugged.
Perhaps, but minds change.
Not this one, Toron said. Where's Mal?
He stepped into view at her side. Tall for a youth, he conveyed an aura of power that filled his dark eyes. Toron called out to him, but he did not speak or even acknowledge that he'd heard Toron.
I swear I'll kill you for what you've done, Toron growled, turning his gaze upon Elsin.
It's not too late, you know, she said, stepping close to the prison wall.
You can still join me. I'd rather see you in a grave.
Please, father, Mal asked. Mother made me better now, yet you are filled with hate. Did you not want me to be healed?
His tone was different from their encounter at the ancient tower, more subdued, almost timid. He wanted Toron to join them, but Toron recognized the glimmer of madness in the youth's gaze, the legacy of the Guardian's spell.
Mal,
Toron said. In an instant his anger was replaced by an ache, and he reached out to touch the wall.
You don't understand.
Mal shook his head, sending his dark hair dancing in front of his eyes.
If you could only see what Mother has done, you would never have betrayed her.
Me betray her? He asked. She broke you.
Mal's eyebrows knit together.
She made me whole.
You were whole.
Mal shook his head and retreated.
You don't understand, but you will soon. Then Mother will decide to keep you or destroy you.
He turned and departed, leaving Toron to slam his fist helplessly against the wall. Elsin took her son's place and met Toron's gaze, her expression inscrutable. Toron looked to her with hatred and loathing. Don't worry, she said. Your stay won't be pleasant, but it won't be long. And at least you'll get to witness my final victory. Galathon snarled at her.
You think your intrigue will gain praise from the oracles?
She burst into a mocking laugh. You thought I was here for the Empire? You truly know nothing. Her words managed to breach the haze of anger.
But you serve the oracles.
I don't want to serve the oracles, she said, and smiled. I want to be an oracle. Chapter 25 Elenir's Gambit. As midnight approached, Alidian paced in her tent, barely able to contain her mounting tension. After her mother's rising, Alidian had filled the pit and sought to comfort the people that her mother had died. She hid her consternation, confusion, and anger behind a mask of sorrow. Alidian had ordered privacy, and Devkin remained outside the tent, ensuring they would not be interrupted. To protect against anyone overhearing, she'd placed muffling charms about the tent, forming a bubble that allowed her to pace in solitude. Long after dark, a burst of greenish smoke erupted from the ground, and her mother rose into view. Her flesh still showed the ethereal green from before, but the solidity remained. Dressed in a translucent cloak and cowl, she wore a sword at her side and looked every inch the warrior. Daughter, she said with a smile.
Mother!
Elenir's smile faded, and she sighed.
Perhaps I owe you an explanation.
Do you have any idea what the last 2 days have been like? Alidian demanded. I watched you rise from the dead and then disappear. I don't even know what you are, and I've been trying to comfort the people that think you dead. Did you die? Are you even an elf anymore? I can't believe you left with barely...
I'm sorry, Elenir said. I should have told you what I intended.
Why didn't you?
Because I didn't know if it would work, Elenir replied.
You mean it could have killed you?
Elenir let out a long breath. I was dealing with unknown magics, and there was a good chance I would die in agony.
What exactly did you do?
I gave up my life for a new one, she said.
But why? Alidian asked. Why risk it?
Because I wanted more, Elenir said, her voice filling with emotion. I've been an oracle for over 800 years and witnessed hundreds of thousands of lives, yet never had one of my own.
I don't understand, Alidian said, her anger dissipating against the yearning in her mother's voice. Elenir looked away. Being an oracle is a heavy mantle, she said. But in the last 100 years I endured the weight of betrayal by those I loved and felt the agony of helplessness. I would have given anything to fight, to defy the fate that my sisters had chosen, to choose my own future. Shocked to silence, Alidian realized she hardly knew her mother. Elenir had displayed the pinnacle of grace, always smiling in the face of conflict, always serene despite the omnipresent burden of knowledge. Yet she had not been happy.
Then what is this? Alidian asked, gesturing to her changed body. Surely you did not desire this fate?
Elenir laughed wryly. The night before the battle at Skykeep, I wanted to see if you would escape. But since I could not watch your fate, I watched Devkin's future. I foresaw his arrival in Dawn's Keep, and witnessed the destruction caused by your escape.
You acted like you didn't know what happened, Alidian said.
Elenir smiled. I may have seen your escape, but I did not know about the magic of rage. I also saw you bring the Herending dagger.
Alidian stared at her. You planned to take your magic?
I did, Elenir said with a smile. With just a day to prepare, I realized I had a choice. Become magicless, or become something more.
I can see the choice you made, Alidian said wryly.
Elenir smiled in delight and dropped into the earth, rising a moment later behind Alidian. She spun in a circle, sending green smoke cascading away from her form. Her smile widened at her newness of self. Alidian could not stop the smile.
That leaves only the question of how.
I used the poison, Elenir said. Instead of stopping it, I gave it more power.
You enhanced the poison that was killing you?
I gave it the power to consume my very flesh, leaving the essence of my being untouched. I was just days from dying in tremendous agony, but the Herending dagger severed the link to my flesh, causing it to wither. Leaving this, Alidian said, gesturing to her body.
Do you still have your magic?
None of it, Elenir said, her eyes twinkling with excitement. I have become ethereal, but my power is now linked to the flaws in my flesh.
The flaws? Alidian asked.
The oracles have always known more than the people, but some truths were reserved for the High Oracle alone. One truth is that magic is linked to flaws in a person's body. Without such flaws, magic could not exist.
I don't understand.
Elenir regarded her for several moments. When this war comes to a close, I will share with you the truth regarding magic and the Kray.
The Kray? Alidian asked.
The ancient race, Elenir said with a nod. There are secrets regarding the dawn of magic that you must know to protect the people.
How does a high oracle pass on the knowledge? Alidian asked. They do not always know that death is upon them.
Elenir gave a mischievous smile. The truth does not usually come from your predecessor. It comes from the Eternals.
Alidian rubbed her forehead and sighed. Mother, I don't need more enigmas.
My apologies, Elenir said. All will be revealed when the time has come.
So what now? Alidian asked.
You guide the rebellion, she said. And I get to fight.
How? Alidian asked. You're very recognizable.
She smiled and passed a hand over her face, and the ethereal green began to change, the light darkening and turning to the color of flesh. Her cloak shifted to black, the cowl solidifying around her features. Alidian stared in astonishment
as her mother turned solid. The only indication of her change was that her eyes were now a startling green, like glowing emeralds.
"My body is now made of light," Elenir said, "and I have some control over my appearance. It's not exactly magic, but it serves its purpose."
She drew her sword and passed it through her arm, both flashing green at the contact.
"Do you ever cease to amaze?" Alidian asked, awed by what her mother had become. "I'm still your mother," she said softly. Tears filled Alidian's eyes. "You were always more."
Elenir closed the gap, tears appearing in her eyes as they embraced, the contact almost solid. But Alidian felt the strength and realized that, shed of her physical form, her mother was now stronger than a rock troll, as if her flesh had limited her true power. For a long moment Alidian clung to her mother, the sudden emotion closing her throat. Then her mother whispered in her ear,
"Please, forgive the selfishness of an old woman."
Alidian pulled away to wipe her tears.
"You cheat death so you can continue to fight. That's hardly selfish."
She grinned.
"You may now consider me a soldier in your army. I will no longer age, but a blade can cut me when I phase to solid, if they can get close enough to strike."
She smiled in anticipation.
"What would you have me do?"
Alidian considered for a moment, and then a slow smile spread on her face.
"Raiden said he couldn't get into the castle at Tarosian to find out what the oracles are up to. Care to make a second attempt?"
Elenir smiled and turned ethereal again, the colors fading to green smoke.
"Never forget I love you," she said with a wink.
"And I you," Alidian said with a smile. "But if you're going to risk your life, I want to know in advance next time."
"I swear it," she said.
Smoke billowed from her cloak as she dropped through the ground, disappearing from view. Still uncertain what to make of the exchange, Alidian stared at the spot for several minutes, her smile slowly fading. She was happy for her mother, but Elenir's choice still left the burden of the rebellion on Alidian's shoulders. Realizing it could have been worse, that her mother could have died, did not help much.
"Devkin," she called, extinguishing the muffling charms.
Her captain of the guard entered the tent and glanced about.
"Did she come?"
"She did," Alidian said with a sigh.
"And?"
Alidian detailed the exchange, right down to her new abilities. The only part she reserved for herself was the information about the Kray and the Eternals, whoever they were. Devkin remained silent throughout, but his expression revealed the swath of his emotions. Confusion, surprise, and finally doubt passed across his face.
"What is she?" he asked when she was finished.
"I know not," Alidian said, and peeked into her mother's tree. "But the people will think her a spirit."
"They revered her as an oracle," Devkin agreed. "Now she will inspire fear."
"Fortunately, she does not appear as she once did," Alidian said. "They will not recognize her as Elenir."
"So that's it?" Devkin asked. "To the world, Elenir Elshiria, High Oracle of Luminea, is dead?"
"To all but us," Alidian said with a nod. "Spread the word. We'll have a memorial tomorrow before our final advance to Herosian."
"Think you can feign grief?"
"I'll have to," she sighed. "My mother has turned into a mythical warrior. I may not understand, but at least she is still mine."
"I think," she mentally added.
Devkin was nodding.
"But if her power is truly as you say, she can make a difference in this war."
"How?"
"What do you see when you look into her future?" he asked.
Alidian dipped into her farsight and searched Elenir's future but had difficulty locating her tree. When she did, her tree was the largest Alidian had ever seen. She gasped as she watched some of the branches rise to the heavens. showing a life of thousands of years, if she survived. "My mother's future is no longer what it once was," Alidian said, hesitant to share the details.
"But her future was difficult to locate, was it not?"
Alidian's eyes settled on him. "How would you know that?"
"She is not the same person," Devkin said. "Her very makeup has been altered. And if you have a difficult time foreseeing her..."
"Then Tariah and Maressa will be equally as lost," Alidian said. "What do you suggest?"
"If your mother is going to infiltrate the fortress, she will have to reveal herself. But if Tariah was distracted by a conversation of peace..."
Alidian realized what he was insinuating and nodded. "A farsight meeting," she said. The oracles had been using their farsight to meet for ages, allowing them to meet in a location that no one could overhear. The private councils were the backbone of the oracles and served as a way for them to meet, even when in distant lands.
"But why would she accept?" she asked. "Because Tariah will be curious," Devkin said confidently. "We arrive in Herosian in 4 days. When we do, she will expect you to seek a conversation. When that happens, your mother can infiltrate the castle."
"And find out exactly what Tariah is up to," Alidian said. But her smile turned into a frown. "How do I get a message to Elenir?"
"She is smart," Devkin said. "She's still learning her abilities and will be patient. When you provide the opportunity, she'll take it."
Alidian frowned. "I'll be talking to Tariah about peace, while my mother sneaks into the fortress?"
"Exactly," he said.
She laughed sourly.
"It appears I have finally become an oracle."
She wasn't certain she liked it.
Chapter 26 Madness. The Griffin Rebellion arrived at Herosian shortly after midday. At the head of the army, Alidian topped a hill and brought her steed to a halt. Although Alidian had seen the newly built city in her farsight, she sucked in her breath at the sight. In the span of months, the Verinai had built a city and a fortress, the battlements high and thick. The city walls were manned by a massive army, complete with entities, sentients, and guardians. The castle at the center of the city rose to an imposing height, its walls fortified by stone mages, so they were nearly unbreakable. Towers and ramparts were further lined with war machines designed to cast missiles all the way to the city wall, allowing the central keep to reinforce the entire city. Of all the city's defenses, a quartet of massive objects drew the eye, for there was not one titan. There were four. Situated at the four points of the compass, the giant statues were humanoid in shape, but each was distinct in form. One boasted four arms, while another had a huge barbed tail. The third resembled a traditional warrior, albeit with giant spikes littering its body. The last faced them and looked like a winged demon. Alidian's eyes widened as the demon titan shifted its feet as if eager for the approaching battle. A hand the size of a castle gate opened, and fire poured from its veins, igniting across its fingers. The sight of the titans caused the rebellion army to recoil, many of the soldiers crying out in fear, their horses responding in kind. General Astyn moved quickly to quell doubt, and issued orders for their army to surround Herosian. After a moment's hesitation, Duke Senin obeyed the order and their forces began to spread out. It quickly became apparent that the rebellion had amassed a larger army, but sheer numbers would not be enough. A single titan could destroy thousands of troops and withstand enormous damage. But even with such an advantage, the Empire's army did not wish to fight. They stood on the battlements in silence as they were slowly surrounded, making no move to strike at those seeking to trap them. Banners waved in the twilight as the rebellion forces came to a halt and formed ranks, the rearmost pitching tents, and harvesting wheat from the supply wagons, settling in for an extended siege. At the front of the line, the soldiers began building their own makeshift fortifications